crimes of Zionism, and distinguishing between Zionism and Jewishness and Judaism. So that's unforgivable, because the essence of Zionism, an axiom of Zionism, even before they chose to fall upon the people of Palestine, even when they were discussing Uganda, Patagonia, etc., Madagascar, the axiom was that Jews could not live among others as a minority, had to leave Europe and fall upon some people and colonize them. So to distinguish, to repudiate Zionism completely is unacceptable to Namod. It's unacceptable to people who are trying against every day's news headline to straddle the divide between support for Israel in some way and the grotesque crimes of that state. Today, 115 medical workers were assassinated, shot in the back of the head, and it seems with their hands tied behind their back. This is Israel, and this is the picture that the world has now absorbed to a huge extent. If you're trying to maintain any kind of link to that genocidal entity, then you're going to fight somebody who says not that there was a fall from grace in 1967, but it was a genocide. It had an inbuilt tendency to genocide and a settler colonial project from its very inception.
Sure.
You can't bridge that gulf. So, of course, they're going to go for every anti-Zionist without exception. And David's victory was extremely prominent and valuable to all of us.
Indeed it was. Well, our next report looks at the role played by a key Zionist think tank in delegitimizing support for Palestine and criticism of Israel.
Namod was quick to condemn the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood as terrorism and a war crime. It also has called for the unconditional release of what it calls all Israeli hostages. When considering the focus of the organization on trying to draw in supporters of Palestinians and Palestinians specifically to its vicinity, it terms to represent a form of strategic engagement, which a key Zionist think tank suggested to deal with delegitimization over a decade ago. The Root Institute was founded in 2004, and its first client was Israel's National Security Council. The think tank asserts that it was established to serve Israeli government agencies and decision makers, from top-ranking politicians to government professionals who hold positions of authority, leadership, or influence. It proudly carries out these services for Israeli government agencies free of charge, though it is handsomely funded by a network of Zionist billionaires. The Root Institute released an introductory video listing the following Israeli government agencies as clients: the Bureau of the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Industry, Trade and Labor, the IDF, the National Economic Council, and the aforementioned National Security Council. Over a decade ago, the Root Institute published a paper defining London as a hub for delegitimization of Israel. The group put forth a two-pronged strategy for dealing with what it termed, on one hand, delegitimizers, and on the other hand, criticizers. Delegitimizers were to be shut down at every opportunity, with venues that host them harassed until cancellation. On the other hand, critics were to be allowed to exist, but be targeted by what Root terms strategic engagement strategies to drag them in the direction of accepting Zionism, even if only partially. The question must be asked, is Namod a form of strategic engagement to facilitate normalization by stealth based on the Root Institute model?
David, what do you make of this Root Institute that just referred to in the film there?
Well, I mean, as the film was suggesting, they've been doing all this work for the Zionist regime. And they did this famous report, as the film mentions there, the London is a hub of delegitimization report, which has been extremely influential throughout the Zionist movement, not just in relation to an organization like Namod, but the whole Zionist movement. So that strategy they've adopted to distinguish between the criticizers, which you might say would include someone like Namod, and sometimes people who are a bit more radical than Namod as well. I mean, PSC would be included in that, and other Stop the War probably is part of that, who are not fundamentally opposed to the existence of the state of Israel, which, of course, any proper anti-Zionist is. Mm-hmm. So they want to make a distinction between those who are delegitimizers, who believe that that there's no legitimacy to the Jewish state, to the state of Israel, and it must be dismantled, yeah. And those who are just a bit concerned about apartheid or the occupation or human rights or even genocide. I mean, they're concerned about genocide, but they don't want to actually deal with having to solve the problem of genocide. And the only way to solve the problem of genocide, as everybody can see, yeah. is to abolish Zionism and to dismantle the Zionist state. So it's a strategy which has been adopted across the whole of the Zionist movement,
yeah.
And you can really place almost every Zionist organization on some kind of continuum, how close they are to being criticizers, and how close they are to being in the home domain of Zionism.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, Nick, I mean, it seems the Root Institute labeled London, then, as we heard in the film there, as the hub of delegitimization. I mean, how does that make you feel in Scotland?
I feel great. We dined out for a very long time on the Israeli diplomats who told Haaretz that every visit to Scotland was like a visit, quote, to enemy territory. That's the position we wish to try to defend going forward. But, you know, when Palestine Action come into the field and we slipped down the league from near the top, we're delighted. And I think in many ways, London is the hub of delegitimization. You have 1 million people marching through London. We haven't achieved that kind of ratio up here. That would be about 100,000. We've not come near it. So, yeah, London has achieved a lot. But, you know, I think what your introduction and what David has said is absolutely true. You've kind of removed the need to add much to it. But Reut and other, especially Reut, but other institutions have concluded that Israel is indefensible, that you don't want to talk about what Israel is doing. I mean, way back 20 years ago, the EU conducted an opinion poll, and some poor junior accidentally included Israel in the poll, and it came top across the whole of Europe. Citizens thought that it was the major threat to world peace, or more of them thought Israel was a major threat to world peace than any other country. So Israel looked at that and recognized it as a profound crisis in terms of hostility. So you can't simply stand your ground and defend Israel. What you have to do is divide and rule, is win over some people to a soft or very muted opposition, and isolate those who refuse to be to be put in that camp. So for years, we've been accused of Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, support for terrorism. I don't know what that is. It's just a constant rain. But other softer groups don't come in for the same treatment. So it's an attempt to divide and rule. That's part of the DNA of Zionism inside Palestine and out. And who's surprised? You can't defend the project called Zionism and what Israel does, so you have to try and split the opposition in order to weaken it.
So I suppose the inescapable conclusion then, David, is that Nahmad is part of this sort of strategic engagement idea aimed at criticism of Zionism.
Well, the Zionist movement, since its very beginning, since the beginning of the post-existence of occupied Palestine, so when they created this state in 1948, they had their first Zionist Congress, World Zionist Congress, in Jerusalem in 1951, I think it was. And that's when they created the mission statement of the Zionist movement. And the mission statement included spreading Zionist ideas all over the world. I mean, it's perfectly clear that that's what they were doing. And that, of course, is the role of the Zionist movement. So when it comes to trying to influence people who are critical of Zionism, they have to have organizations who seem like they're more sympathetic or more liberal Zionists, people even who say that they're non-Zionist, and some who say they're anti-Zionist. Now, not all of those who say that they're anti-Zionist are anti-Zionist in any kind of material or straightforward way. And that's of course, the difficulty is that some people, even they might even believe that they're anti-Zionist, but they're not really anti-Zionist. And that's partly a question of a sort of penetration strategy by the Zionist movement. And Nahmad clearly is part of that strategy. Now, everyone in Nahmad might not know that, they might not believe that, but that's the purpose of Nahmad, is to try and isolate those who are sort of more thoroughgoingly anti-Zionist from those who are a bit more questionable.
No, indeed. Well, Mick, I assume that PSC Scotland's not going to be platforming Nahmad anytime soon then.
people carry in their heads strange ideas. I mean, some people still think Columbus discovered America. They're not hardcore racists. We are perfectly ready to engage with people if they have, you know, backward ideas. But it depends on the direction they're moving in. If people are breaking from Zionism and moving, however stumblingly, however with whatever difficulty, towards support for Palestinian rights and freedom and abandoning Jewish supremacy, then we'd be delighted to engage with them. But if they're dug in and trying to bring other people towards these positions of not criticizing Zionism root and branch, then I don't see any possibility for serious engagement. But yes, we'd be happy to engage with them in order to see who among them was prepared to make the final step towards repudiating Zionism. Look, many of us have had to repudiate reactionary ideas. I know people who grow up in all sorts of backgrounds. We had to repudiate the idea that Churchill was anything other than a rancid racist, or that the British Empire was endless pillage and massacre and conquest. We had to break from those ideas. Yeah. So nobody's exempt from that. But if people are not prepared to, and if people are, if, you know, I'll engage with people who are moving away from those ideas. But if they're promoting ideas that the British Empire was justified in pillaging the world, there's nothing to discuss. And it's the same with Namod. If they're dug in any way defending the genocidal state, Israel has a right to exist, blah, 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 then what's to discuss?
Yeah, well, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So a special thank you to our guest, Mick Napier. And thanks, of course, to our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from Arab English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and explain some precious points in their view. Well, on the essence of faith, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, the essence of Islam is faith, and its implementation is by practicing the principles of truth and justice.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Well, discussion of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi reflects fundamental concepts in Shia Islam that interlinks belief with ethical conduct in social and personal spheres. You know, faith or iman represents a deep-rooted acknowledgement of God's existence and attributes, as well as an unwavering commitment to the teachings brought forth by Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. In the Shia tradition, faith is not merely an inward feeling, but a powerful catalyst for action. The Holy Book of Quran emphasizes this connection by saying, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات. Indeed, those who have believed and done righteous deeds. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 82. This verse reinforces the belief that true faith necessitates the active pursuit of good deeds, which include upholding the principles of truth and justice. Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is known as the epitome of justice in Islamic thought, stated, "The just ruler is like a shadow of God on the earth." And this highlights how justice is not only a legal principle, but also a divine obligation, requiring Muslims to embody fairness and equity in all dealings. Implementing justice leads to the establishment of morally upright society, which is a manifestation of true belief. Furthermore, truth or haq is a fundamental principle in Shia Islam, as indicated again in the Holy Book of Quran, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, and do not mix the truth with falsehood or conceal the truth while you know. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 42. You see, this verse calls upon the believers to uphold truthfulness in all facets of life. In summary, the essence of Islam, viewed through the Shia lens, underscores that faith must translate into action, particularly in advocating for truth and justice. This commitment not only strengthens personal belief, but fosters a just and equitable society, aligning with the core values of Shia Islam and the prophetic traditions. Okay, well, dear listeners, that was the time we have for this episode. For ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about the essence of faith. He said, "The essence of Islam is faith, and its implementation is by practicing the principles of truth and justice."
Every night and every day. Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Pieces of bread from me, and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. Peace be upon him.
Jannah,
النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge with Sheikh Mukhtar on IRIB English Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 185th sermon, and this is one of those areas where Imam Ali alayhi salam tries to draw our attention towards an important issue that can face the society, and that is to be engrossed in blessings and become forgetful about the duties that are necessary to be executed by each and every member of the community. And once these blessings become many, they can lead to certain side effects. So a community needs to be prepared on how to deal with these kinds of blessings. How should a person, prepare himself and the society to combat these difficulties? So those difficulties are that a society now, because of those difficulties that come due to extra blessings and not being able to kind of plan for those blessings in the right way, lead to backtracking of the society sometimes and can be very dangerous. Inshallah, we shall discuss about what are those difficulties that a community can face.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, if you remember in the previous session, we talked about the fact that when the blessings become too much, the material forms of blessings, when they are multitudinous, then one of the dangers is that we can have a society which is divided, whereby the rich become richer and the poor remain to be poor, and sometimes even become poorer. Why? Especially this happens when the wealth is not distributed well, and there is no proper planning and organization in place to be able to do that. So firstly, this has to be given very much attention to. But sometimes, even if these systems are in place, people do not abide by the law, and they become corrupt, and they tend to bypass all of these systems to achieve their material objectives. So this is a problem that can be faced, and these are the things that actually lead to the backtracking of the society, and the society sees that, for example, their aims are not being achieved because of the fact that now people are more focused on enjoying life, on just spending without any proper order, and therefore this society ends up to be just a materialistic society, in the right, if you want to say, and and it can have other effects in the future. We've seen that happening to the societies in the past also. When the communities become affluent, then they become forgetful of God, and then they become forgetful of what they need to achieve as servants of God. Now, apart from that, there's also another effect that can affect the society, and that is that people themselves can become spoilt. They can suffer spiritual harm. Inshallah, we shall discuss about this in the coming segment.
Sayyid Razi, also known as Sharif Razi, a religious scholar and theologian, holds a significant place in Islamic history for his invaluable contribution to the compilation of Imam Ali's profound teachings and speeches, which were later compiled into the influential literary work known as Nahjul Balagha.
Now, it is completely natural that people, when they see a lot of wealth, they kind of get excited about that wealth. They want to spend it in different ways, and they want to just achieve an affluent life. I mean, this is something that people normally dream about. And this is, we need to be realistic. Many people, unfortunately, in the world, they are materialistic in their mindset. I'm not saying most people, but many have that idea. But they should realize, firstly, that primarily it is not wrong to think about material progress. And even if a person likes it, likes the glitter, liking it by itself is not bad. Being attached to it and not being focused on spirituality because of these things is what is not encouraged. So therefore, a person should ask himself sincerely that why does he want or she want to achieve this material affluence? Now, many times with communities and people face these material blessings, they dive into them. And when suddenly their material, their material wealth and their material state becomes vast, they forget other things. They get so engrossed. Al-mal wal-banun zinatul hayat dunya. Because wealth and children are the beauty of this world, right? And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made it as a test for us, you know. زَيَّنَّا مَا عَلَى الْأَرْضِ. We have made beautiful that which is on top of the earth. We have made it look beautiful, rather. زَيَّنَّا. It looks beautiful. And then he says, إِنَّا جَعَلْنَا مَا عَلَى الْأَرْضِ زِينَةً لَهَا. We have made that which is on top of the earth a beauty for the earth. لِنَبْلُوَكُمْ. So that we can test you. You see, so these are some things that we need to keep in mind, that if we take these as a test, then inshallah we can overcome and we can easily be able to balance our lives in a way that we can also achieve our spiritual goals. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar in the program Gate of Knowledge on RIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منى.
وفي المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
The spacious palace with white stones surrounded by trees and green grass is the Levadia Palace. It is located in and was once the home of the last Russian Tsar, but is now the residence of a U.S. delegation. Today is February 4th, 1945. In this 116-room palace, three powerful countries are supposed to gather together and discuss an important issue. The flags of the three countries have been hoisted. The troops are all ready for a military reception. Everything is ready, and the ceremonial automobile enters the premises. The first guest is a 71-year-old man. He has a strange addiction to his Cuban cigars. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. It doesn't take long for Joseph Stalin, the host of this major meeting, to arrive. Stalin is a 65-year-old short man with a thin mustache. His first official mission was to organize government and military files. He is now going to sit at this round table and decide about the fate of the world as the leader of the Soviet Union. But the third chair belongs to Franklin Roosevelt. The New York Times wrote about his first 100 days in office as president. He takes power like a dictator. Paralyzed from the waist down due to polio when he was young, Roosevelt could hardly stand on his own two feet without help. However, he has come to this meeting as the head of one of three powerful countries. The theme of the meeting is the future of the world after the Second World War. Adolf Hitler, leader of Nazi Germany, with his trademark mustache, greatly disturbed the UK, the US, and the Soviet Union for his territorial expansion dreams after grabbing power. They had to stand up against him so that their powers in the world would not be debilitated. The alliance of the trio states against Germany achieved the predicted results in World War II. After these three superpowers got involved in the war, the German Nazis' wings were clipped and paved the way for Allied nations to enter this huge palace. They're supposed to talk about the defeat of Nazi Germany and share their achievements from the war. 8 days later, while the three major leaders are standing in front of the cameras, no one knows what lies behind the smiles of the three commanders. Their words are going to change the future of the world. And this story is not an ordinary story. It is a complex story about the future of the largest military organization in the world today, NATO. It was the 28th of July, 1914, when the First World War broke out. Amid the news of the destruction of cities in the war, some news has gone viral among the people. The world's first communist country was born. The country is called the Soviet Union. People in the world have not yet gotten used to the name of this large country when the International Communist Organization is formed with the aim of making the world communist. A great fear arises among the European powers. By now, everyone has understood that communism intends to form a classless society whose economy is controlled by the government and its citizens are under the scrutiny of the government. They have no other goal than to serve the society. Just opposite to the capitalist system that is the dominant mindset of Western countries these days. In order to achieve maximum profit, the capitalist system bases the society's administration on free elections and manages the economy, production, and agriculture by private individuals. So it is a serious opponent of communism. These two views will remain in opposition to each other until Germany becomes the dominant power in the world. For this man with his toothbrush mustache, the dream of territorial expansion is not something that would bring Soviet communists and Western capitalists under a united flag. Ideological differences between the two gradually fade away. But just when everything is in place to create a front against the Germans, the UK and France refuse to agree. They do not trust the communists who intend to bring the world under their banner. The Soviet leader is annoyed by this hesitation. Ever since he chose the Russian name Stalin for himself, he became known as Iron Man, an Iron Man who knows very well what decision to make for the communists in critical moments. August 1939, some news spreads in the world. The news shocks the West much more than the news of the destruction of cities in the First World War. The Soviet Union and Germany reach an agreement. The text of the agreement, which is signed on the non-aggression of both countries and the division of Eastern Europe between them, War II. On September 1, 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Everything is going according to the agreement by the two countries, but on June 22, 1941, Hitler orders a massive attack against Soviet territories, an attack that is referred to as the largest and most extensive military attack. Stalin feels completely desperate. He has no choice but to fight the Germans. He now pivots to the West. Stalin desperately needs their help to succeed in the war. Germany's advance in the war scared Roosevelt and Churchill, so they get on board to negotiate with Stalin. However, they're still worried about the consequences of their move. Will Stalin remain loyal to them? No one knows. The only thing they are sure about is the danger of the German army's massive penetration in Europe. Roosevelt and Churchill make their decision. They extend a hand of friendship to Stalin. The private meetings where Roosevelt and Churchill call Stalin Uncle Joe for more intimacy. After news about the alliance spreads around the world, some believe that they have put aside their political differences. But no one knows that heads of these three countries themselves have no decision for this. They get together in their meetings and drink and dine and take photos in honor of one another. But in their minds, they dream and fantasize about defeating each other. The alliance takes its toll on Germany. Hitler is the loser of the war. The US, the UK, and the Soviet Union are the winners. Now they have to sit and once again discuss the spoils of war, of which European territory is the main one. The city of Potsdam will host the Allied states once again. The Allied states that have experienced changes in the past few months. President Roosevelt has passed away. People in the US will replace Roosevelt with his first vice president, Harry Truman.
In 2144A.
The inexperienced Truman is sent to Potsdam Conference as the chief negotiator. The Americans now know Stalin better. After their new president meets him, they become emboldened and nicknamed the Soviet leader the Little Bud. Although the Soviet government managed to expand its borders a few hundred kilometers to the west and establish its dependent regimes throughout Eastern Europe, not all countries under its influence have yet become communist. The US and UK have repeatedly asked the Soviet Union to hold free elections in the Baltic states, Poland, and other parts of Eastern Europe, but the communist dictator refrained from taking any practical step. Stalin makes his decision. The devastating Soviet losses in the war have made Stalin unable to flex its muscles. He needs to take prudent steps. He makes his decision. The Westerners' wish for elections is fulfilled, but the Eastern European countries will have to hold an election whose leaders are acceptable to the Soviet government. But Stalin is facing a big problem to implement this policy. Some European countries, like Poland, do not like communism. They have never forgotten the memory of Hitler's attack and Stalin's initial support for them in 1939. In Poland, Stalin has no choice but to impose his puppet government on them, otherwise Poland will slip out of his control. But it not only made Poland hate communism even more, but also made Stalin's allies, namely the US and UK, doubtful. Their hesitation did not go away even until 2 weeks before Roosevelt's death. Roosevelt believes that Stalin will not fulfill any of the promises he made for peace between European countries. At that time, if Roosevelt knew he would not live long enough to participate in the Potsdam Conference, he would have given his first Vice President Truman some advice about Stalin. In 1946, the Soviet Intelligence Service, which was assigned by Stalin to spy, gained access to a long and secret telegram. The telegram was from a young officer at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, George F. Keenan. Stalin checks the telegram in detail. It seems to be an important telegram. The more he scrutinizes it, the less he is successful in seeing a solution from the U.S. In the letter, Keenan reports to his authorities, Soviet leaders are forced to treat the outside world as a hostile world because this is the only excuse for a dictatorship without which they did not know how to rule. There will be no change in the Soviet Union's strategy until it has suffered a long enough streak of defeats to convince the future leader of the Kremlin that Soviet behavior is not in their interests. There is no need for war to achieve this result. Stalin is completely confused. How is the U.S. going to face the Soviet Union this time? In June 1947, Truman designated the sullen military man George Marshall as his Secretary of State. Marshall, one of the commanders of World War II, who received the title of the Designer of Victory from Churchill due to his management, proposed a solution for this problem. The United States should commit to rebuilding post-war Europe with economic aid. Stalin knows better than anyone what reconstruction means. Little by little, with the implementation of the Marshall Plan in Western Europe, the ideological frameworks of communism start shaking. The financial guarantees provided by the U.S. aid enabled Western European governments to begin building their modern welfare states. The working class in European countries who are enjoying a better lifestyle completely forget communism. September 1947, Stalin finally steps in.
Leaders of the party and government, representatives of the various Soviet republics, and of the Communist and Workers' Party.
The Common Form, or the pre-war International Communist Organization, is what Stalin has been thinking about for a while. Stalin believed when the goal of the Common Form became loyalty to the main principles in the international communist movement, the space for freedom of opinion among Europeans would become narrower. Now it is Truman's turn to act against Stalin. He checks all the options. The problem has only one solution. In 1948, just as the Italian people were busy casting their votes in elections, the CIA planned a secret operation. The operation had a clear effect on the election. Communism loses the election. Stalin is still stunned by the election results which makes the situation more complicated for him. It was really painful for the Soviet leader. Czechoslovakia, the only democratic government in Eastern Europe, attempted a coup that year. The developments and the suspicious death of the Czechoslovak foreign minister, Jan Masaryk, sends a clear message to the communist opposition. Other Europeans all know that any opposition to Stalin's sphere of influence will eventually result in a Masaryk-style repression. Eastern Europeans are all horrified by Stalin's policies, all but one country, Yugoslavia. Josip Broz Tito, the communist leader of Yugoslavia, came to power on his own and does not need Stalin to stay in power. He is a danger to the Soviet government these days. Tito seems to have gotten bored with Stalin's policies due to Cominform's insistence. He has made a serious decision to cut off his country's relations with Moscow. Tito finally does it a year later. Although Stalin's indifference on this issue is a bit mysterious, is there anyone in the Soviet Union who does not know that the incident can send a shockwave through the communist pillars? Stalin has become confused. Moscow has not yet recovered when it was reported that the Soviet leader had taken military action. Berlin, the capital of Germany, was sieged. In a war that took several years, everyone already understood that if neutral Germany gradually tilts toward the Soviets, the Cold War in Europe will be in favor of the communists. But if the opposite happens and Germany moves towards the US, things will get much worse for the Soviet Union. A part of Germany fell into the hands of the Americans that was considered the richest and most developed part of Europe. If the US wants, it can easily turn the region into a powder keg to attack the Soviet Union. Therefore, Stalin should move more cautiously against Germany. Stalin, who thinks the solution is to lay a siege on Berlin, makes the US Army spring into action. They deliver food and other necessities to the besieged city by building an air bridge. Berlin appreciates the move. The Westerners are now a friendly face in the eyes of the German people, as opposed to Stalin, who now has a wild and powerless image in front of the world. The US government gradually takes over the communists. Meanwhile, the Soviet government has no idea that Truman was up in arms to shatter their ideology. In November 1947, a plan was prepared by the Joint Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army called Broiler. The main goal of the plan was to destroy the Soviet Union's ability to wage a war using massive atomic bombardment. The plan considers 34 atomic bombs against 24 Soviet cities at a time the medical reports from the experiments conducted on the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan's atomic bombing are still on Truman's desk. Truman knows very well what consequences await the Soviet Union. However, he prefers to continue sipping his French coffee at his desk and run up and down the report statistics. 2 years later, when over 200 atomic bombs and 20 bombers were prepared for the operation, Truman met with some military experts. They believe that if the U.S. fails to prevent atomic bombing, the bombs may not be effective enough to destroy the Soviet Union's ability to fight. At this time, Truman receives a recommendation from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which makes him think about finding a solution. The Joint Chief of Staff believes the U.S. forces cannot defend Western Europe against the communists, even if they use the atomic bomb. Truman must come up with a proper solution. Broiler's plan fails to achieve the objective. Two years later, it was reported that the Soviet Union had tested its first atomic bomb. American scientists start thinking harder. The issue is slowly turning into an arms race. A little later, a group of American nuclear scientists solved Truman's problem in the major war, a thermonuclear bomb or super bomb. Estimates say the new technology can cause an explosion that no one dares tell Truman about the consequences. The only thing everyone is thinking about now is only one thing, not falling behind the Soviet nuclear industry. In the fall of 1948, Truman begins a new chapter of his negotiations with Western European countries. Western Europe is now ready to cooperate with the White House after the implementation of the Marshall Plan in their countries and receiving economic aid from the U.S. The main objective of discussion in Truman's negotiations with Western European countries is a formal treaty of alliance against communist Soviets. Truman finally forms his international union. NATO is the title the European countries now must line up for membership in. In April 1949, the NATO treaty was signed in Washington by 10 European countries, as well as the US and Canada. The contents of the treaty, which were published, put Stalin in a bind. One, if one NATO member country is attacked, all members will provide it with military support. Two, NATO members are committed to cooperating in various military fields, including intelligence exchange, military training, and joint exercises. And three, NATO members should use similar equipment and weapons to facilitate their military cooperation. It is 1955. It's been 2 years since Stalin died. Some news spreads in the world. The news terrifies the Soviet Union. West Germany has joined NATO.
Now we welcome to our company the Federal Republic of Germany, represented here by its great statesman, Dr. Adenauer.
The emergence of a militaristic Germany determined to reunify could be a wake-up call for the Soviet Union that has already been invaded by Germany. During the last days of Stalin's rule, when the political and economic situation in Eastern Europe had deteriorated, his successor, Nikita Khrushchev, must seriously pursue reconstruction and improvement of the situation in Eastern Europe. During these years, East Germany is not doing well. Since 1951, suppression of private businesses by the government, forced membership in collective farms, dissatisfaction with the communist system, and the desire to live in the economic prosperity of the West have driven some East German residents from this region to West Germany. As his first moves, the new Soviet leader resumes ties with Tito. Khrushchev is not happy with Stalin's measures. Yugoslavia resigns the Fraternity Pact with the Soviet Union. But the troubled situation in East Germany and West Germany's accession to NATO will still be big problems for Khrushchev. Khrushchev must find a solution. So he decides to drag 7 Eastern European countries to the Warsaw Pact. Dubbed a military alliance, the treaty commits communist countries of Eastern Europe to help each other in the event of an armed attack by the West. Now Europe is divided into 2 armed groups, the West under NATO and the East under Warsaw. Following these agreements, Soviet tanks were deployed to East Germany in 1953, Hungary in 1956, and Czechoslovakia in 1968 to crack down on anti-communist movements. Although the evidence suggests that NATO is an alliance of sovereign states, the Warsaw Pact appears to be an imperialist enterprise of puppet regimes under the complete domination of Moscow. Now, Western narratives and propaganda have touched on this fundamental difference. However, while NATO insists on introducing itself as a defense association, everyone gradually gets suspicious due to its actions. In 1960, the U.S. proposes a plan called Multilateral Force. The plan seeks to create a navy consisting of ballistic missile submarines and warships with international crews from NATO member states. Military equipment, all of which are armed with ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads. In 1985, something happens in the Soviet Union which shakes the very foundations of communism. Mikhail Gorbachev becomes the leader of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev's economic reforms gradually drag the Soviet Union into serious economic problems. The severe shortage of food resources turns supporters of communism into vocal dissidents. Gorbachev's slogans take Western shape. Although he commemorates communist leaders, when he leads Soviet Union towards democracy and the free world, he is praised by the Western media. He gets overwhelmed by the Western encouragements. The so-called reforms by Gorbachev not only do not solve the Soviets' problems, but also lead to the collapse and fragmentation of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, with all of its violations and evils, at least its geographical scope, could be a defense barrier against the expansionism of Westerners. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the U.S. removes its biggest enemy and the Cold War ends. The U.S. government, which promised Gorbachev that NATO will not advance even an inch towards Russia, in no time it forgets its promise. The promise is going to get the allies of communism involved. The story now reaches Yugoslavia.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds.